So I remember thinking, I am just another speck of sand. And the earth, really, in the cosmic scheme of things, is another speck. And the sun, an unremarkable star, nothing special about the sun. The sun is another speck. And the galaxy is a speck. I'm a speck on a speck, orbiting a speck, among other specks, among still other specks, in the middle of specklessness.
All right, very interesting. Thank you. All right, our topic this morning is why Genesis? Is it really just a collection of old myths, or does it have some relevance for us today? So this is the topic that we're going to look at this morning and also over the next several weeks as we go through the first 11 chapters of Genesis. So before we continue, let's pray. Dear Lord, we do thank you now for who you are, Lord, for all you've done for us. I ask that you help us to understand, Lord, what it means to have a biblical worldview and how that can make a difference for our lives and our society. We thank you now, Lord, for everything. Amen. All right. Maybe it'll even answer the question of whether we are specks or not. All right. So we're going to look at three areas of Genesis this morning. The first area is that it is foundational to many Christian doctrines. Second is that it describes actual real history. And third, that it has an immense consequence for society and for ourselves, which is sometimes referred to as a worldview. Now, the Bible is, of course, a book of moral truths. Is it also a book of science? Well, not really, but, you know, it should be accurate when it talks about a scientific topic. But is it a book of history? Yes, it is. The Bible talks about how everything started and how everything will end, and a lot of important things in between. Now, a lot of people say today that the Bible and Christianity is anti-science, against science. But that's really not the case. If we look in Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, it says this: God blessed them, that is Adam and Eve, and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground." So what does it mean to subdue something and rule over something? Well, you have to understand it, don't you? And you know, the understanding of nature, well, that's a good definition of science. So I would say the Bible is really commanding a study of science here with this verse. Johann Kepler, the father of modern astronomy, he said that science was like thinking God's thoughts after him. How appropriate. A lot of people don't understand this, but you know, most, if not many, of the areas of modern science were actually founded by men and women who were theists, who believed in God, and they believed that God operated the world in a consistent manner and that it could be studied and understood. So people like Da Vinci, Faraday, Kelvin, Mendel, Newton, Pasteur, there's really dozens and dozens of scientific areas that had foundings by those with a Christian worldview. Here's a very important diagram which explains a lot of things about why we have controversy not only in the area of Bible and science, but in many areas of life. And it's the fact that everyone's biased. Yes, you are. You're biased. I'm biased. We're all biased. And the bias that you have will influence your interpretation of facts. So we all have the same facts and data. But for example, if we start with a view that there is no God and therefore some kind of evolutionary process must be true, we're going to look at data and come to a certain conclusion. On the other hand, though, if we believe there is a God and that he created, we'll look at that same data and probably come to quite a different conclusion. One of the examples in this area is the Grand Canyon. It's a specimen, believe it or not, for both evolutionists and creationists, right? The evolutionist says, oh, look what happened here. A little bit of water over a long period of time. Look at the layering. Look at the successive fossil formations in there showing evolution taking place. The creationist, though, the creation scientist says, look, here's an example of a lot of water over a little time from Noah's flood, and what we see there is the remains of Noah's flood. So same information, vastly different conclusions, and you can apply this to politics and many other areas of life also. So we talked about worldview. Well, what is it? Well, it's really the framework for how you answer the big, important questions of life, such as where do we come from? You know, what are we here for? Where are we going? What's wrong? Because there does seem to be something wrong with our world. And what's the solution? So in Genesis, we're going to see that it provides a lot of answers to these important questions. So how about Genesis? Well, it's been interpreted out in many different ways, mostly because people are trying to reconcile modern science with the Bible. So we have things like the gap theory on the upper left there, which says there was a long period of time between the two verses, first two verses of Genesis, Genesis 1:1 and 1:2, and it's during that time that the fossil record was laid down. They also call it the ruin and reconstruction theory, and the idea is Genesis 1, verse 2 starts the reconstruction, but that there was this period there where a lot of things happened, and they kind of discount the flood. So that's been a popular theory in the past, not so much anymore. There's the day-age theory, which says that each Bible day of the 6 days of creation really represents, you know, many, many millions of years, long periods of time. Related to that is the idea of progressive creation, which says that, you know, God stepped in, created some creatures, waited a few million years for things to settle out, created some more creatures, waited some more millions of years, etc. Then there's the idea of theistic evolution, which is very popular nowadays, which says that evolution is true because they think science has proven it, which it really hasn't, but they think so. And so they say, well, evolution is true, but God was behind it. But it's interesting that the evolutionist says that evolution is an unguided process with no forethought, but somehow the theistic evolutionist says, well, God guided an unguided process, if that makes any sense. There's the intelligent design community of the last 20 years or so, very influential nowadays, doing a lot of good work. But they are really just looking to convince people that there must be a designer because of the complexities and the evidences that we find in nature. But they really don't talk about who the designer is, what God is he. They don't talk about the Bible. They don't talk about Genesis. So they're kind of off to the side, but we do think they are doing some good work in as far as they go anyway today. There's the framework hypothesis, which says you shouldn't really be interpreting Genesis literally. It's really there just to say that, hey, there is a God and he's the creator, and that's kind of the main purpose of it. On the left, we see a label, Young Earth Creationism. That is the framework that I'm operating from today and is actually the framework that we'll be using in this 10-part series. And if you're in the life groups looking at the Unlocking the Mysteries of Genesis, that is the framework where the Institute of Creation Research that produced that, that's the framework that they are coming from. Now, if you're new to this ideas, maybe some of this will seem, well, not maybe it will, it'll seem far-fetched, maybe ridiculous, impossible, how can you say that kind of reactions? Because we're all taught continually about millions of years, about evolution, and so many people have that mindset already. But in the end, I think all we can ask for is a fair hearing, you know, see what we have to say about young earth creationism. Might it be true? And I've come to believe in my 30 years of study that we really don't need any of these other theories, that in the end we can interpret Genesis in a straightforward manner and that it very satisfyingly explains a lot of scientific facts and a lot of historical facts. Can we explain everything? No. Can the evolutionists explain everything? No. So there's some things we don't yet understand, but young earth creationism seems to be a very reasonable framework to operate in. So let's talk about that Genesis is foundational to some key Christian doctrines. Well, the Bible starts off, right? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, Genesis 1:1. Now, the Bible doesn't try to prove that God exists. It kind of assumes that everyone knows God exists because it also says in the Bible, and in our hearts, everyone really does know that God exists, but many people try to hide it and try to get away from it. But today, there are people who are more and more challenging this idea about does God exist. For example, here's a recent book from Lawrence Krauss, A Universe from Nothing. It's a bestseller. It's being used in universities, so it's having influence, right? In there he says, it can truly be said that we are all here today because of quantum fluctuations in what is essentially nothing. In this sense, science does not make it impossible to believe in God, but rather makes it possible to not believe in God. Well, what is this thing, a quantum fluctuation? Believe it or not, an empty space is not empty. There's a continual stew of the particles and antiparticles popping into existence and annihilating themselves, and that's kind of shown on the bottom. Kind of the main thesis of his theory is that at least one time the particles popped into existence, but they didn't go away. And so one of these particles eventually turned into our universe, believe it or not. But in the end, his title is a misnomer, right? It's not a universe from nothing. In his case, it's a universe from a quantum field and quantum fluctuation. So we could say, well, where did those come from, right? In other words, there's always going to be this question of, well, where did the prior thing come from, right? In the end, there has to be something bigger and grander than just the physical universe, and that's what we call God. So people may try to run from it, but in the end, you really can't. Interestingly, though, now polls are showing that among young people under the age of 30, about one-third now have serious doubts about whether God even exists or not. All right, so this is not a trivial question. Today, we kind of have to start with that very basic. Yes, God does exist, and here are some good reasons to believe that he does exist, despite what others are saying. Related to this is the idea of the multiverse theory. This is the idea that there may be an almost infinite number of universes, each having a different law of physics. We just happen to live in the one that's just right for life. Lucky us, right? Years ago, scientists used to deny that there was fine-tuning of the universe and the Earth, but there's really no getting away from the fact that the universe is very special. Solar system is special. The Earth is special. And that the odds of this happening through random chance are vanishingly small, basically impossible. So what they say is, well, it may be vanishingly impossible, but if we have an infinite number of universes, then, you know, it could happen. But here's the question, is this really science or not, right? How could we ever prove that there was any other universes other than our own? We could not. So this is not really science, although it's portrayed as such nowadays, but it's really what we might call science fiction or philosophy. The problem, though, is when you watch a show on TV, they'll talk about real science, and then they'll talk about the multiverse theory and not tell you that they went from real science to really some wild speculation now, but that's the case. Another key concept from Genesis is that man's created in the image of God. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. The important point we learn from Genesis is that man is not an animal. Okay, that God created animals separately, and he created people separately. We share a lot of characteristics with animals because we need to live in the same environment, but in fact, we are not an animal. We are not a higher form of an animal. We are a separate and different creation by God. Another thing we learn about in Genesis is that marriage of man and woman is ordained by God. The Lord God said, it's not good for man to be alone. I will make a helper suitable for him. And that is why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife. And of course, this is in the news for the last few years a lot, right? The whole issue of gay marriage. But the Bible really doesn't seem to make any allowance for such a thing. But it's upon us, and we'll deal with it, right? A very key concept is that the original creation was perfect. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. But then something happened, didn't it? The first people, Adam and Eve, they rebelled against God by disobeying his orders not to eat from a particular tree, but they did anyway. And because of that, God did a couple of things. First of all, he said that you are going to begin to die. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken. For dust you are, and to dust you will return. They didn't die right away, but they started to die on that day. A lot of people don't understand, though, that a second thing happened at that point in history, which is that God actually cursed the earth itself. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat of it all the days of your life. God's telling that to Adam and Eve. Later, the Apostle Paul reiterates that in Romans. We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. And so this says, well, why do we have physical evils today like tornadoes, tsunamis, storms, etc.? Well, it's because the original creation's not as perfect as it used to be. And so God relaxed some of his upkeep of the universe, so to speak, and now physical calamities do happen and take place. However, in Genesis, we also see the first promise of a coming Savior. So even though Adam and Eve sinned and rebelled, God was even then making a way for the future to correct the situation. In Genesis 3:15, it says that he, the Savior, that is Jesus, will crush your head, and you, the serpent, will strike his heel. So this is the first promise that God will make things different, and this culminates, of course, with Jesus being here on the earth. And we know that Jesus has already defeated Satan, and that will happen in its last act in the end times. So we see that it's important to look at Genesis as accurate because it is the foundation of the Bible, right? If Genesis is not accurate, then it really places doubts on the entire Bible, doesn't it? And how can we really trust, you know, what's in the New Testament if we really can't trust what's in Genesis and in the Old Testament? But there are people who have, I'll say, blinders, so to speak, and they kind of write off Genesis, they write off the Old Testament as irrelevant. But there's a lot of relationship between the New Testament and the Old Testament, a lot of references back. Even Jesus himself makes references back into the events of Genesis. So believing Genesis, I think, is important. Second area we're going to look at is Genesis is real history. In fact, it's our history. It's my history. It's your history, right? Of how did we get here? In speaking to Job in chapter 38, God says, "Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand." You know, the Bible has the only eyewitness account of our beginnings, right? You and I weren't there, and no scientist was there, right? So scientists make speculations and theories about how things might have started, but in fact, they weren't there to witness it, right? Only God is the witness. In the Bible, it talks about a creation over 6 days, about 6,000 years ago, although I mentioned there are other theories that people have. But in the end, we have to remember it's what? It's a miracle. So even though we may try to think about, well, what kind of processes and physics were involved over these first 6 days, in the end, it was a miracle. And a lot of people will say, well, gee, you know, how could all of that happen so fast? But, you know, if you think about it, if God is God, which he is, you could ask the question the other way, well, why did he take so long, right? Why did God take so long? He could have snapped his finger, right, and put the entire creation into place in an instant, but he didn't. Instead, he used a process over 6 days. And why did he do that? Well, the Bible gives us the answer. It's to give us a model for our own work week, right? This was God's work week in creating. We have the same work week, right, of working 6 days and resting on the seventh. A very important concept, though, in the Bible is that it was a mature creation, and this explains a lot of things. There's really not any signs of evolution in the Bible. And, you know, if God had used evolution, he could have told us and it would have been okay, right? But there's no signs of it there. In Isaiah, it says that God did not create it, that is the heavens or the universe, to be empty, but he formed it to be inhabited. So God had a purpose for what he did, and so he instantiated it, you know, quickly to start serving that purpose, right? There was really no need to wait. So Adam, you know, he was not created as a baby, right? He was a young man, probably 15 to 20 years of age when he was first created. You know, God did not take seeds and sow them on the ground to create the Garden of Eden. No, he created mature trees. At that time, they probably looked, you know, 10, 20, maybe 100 years old. And I think if we had cut one of them down, we probably would have seen tree rings in there. Because a very important concept is that you cannot have a mature creation without an appearance of age. Okay, so there's going to be an appearance of age. Adam appeared to be 20, but he wasn't. The trees appeared to be 100 years old, but they weren't. Even the round pebbles on the ground would have had an appearance of being washed by water and being rounded, but they weren't, right? So there's no getting away from this fact that a mature creation gives an appearance of age. So what we believe is that when secular scientists are measuring, you know, the age of the universe, the age of the earth, what they're really measuring is this consistent apparent age that God created with, okay? And I think it's a nice explanation of things. So let's switch topics a bit now. You know this guy, Charles Darwin. if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down, but I can find out no such case. Well, actually, I think there are these cases. Maybe he just didn't look that much. Let's look at the monarch butterfly. I love this example, and if I have 30 seconds to tell you about creation and why evolution is not true, I'm going to tell you about the monarch butterfly and its life cycle, right? It starts as an egg. Out of the egg comes a caterpillar, crawls around and eats and eats and eats for a couple of weeks. One day it decides, hey, let me hang myself down from the bottom side of a tree. Let me case myself in an enclosure, which we call a chrysalis. And then, believe it or not, let me dissolve my insides down to a bunch of goo, and then let me rebuild that goo into a totally different type of animal with a totally different life cycle. So I'm changing from a caterpillar to a butterfly. Eventually, the butterfly breaks out of that, and you know what? It's that butterfly that lays the egg to start the cycle over again. So think about this. If you cannot evolve through that chrysalis stage in one generation, guess what? No more butterflies, right? End of the line. And you know, that process is so complicated, scientists today don't really even understand exactly how you do that, how you go down to goo and rebuild yourself. So this is an amazing story. And you know, if evolution cannot take place here, we really only need one example, right? If evolution is true, it has to be able to explain everything. If there's even one thing it can't explain, then it can't be true. And I challenge you, look on the internet to find an evolutionary explanation for this, and you won't find it. All you'll find is that, well, it must have come from something simpler. Well, of course, what other answer can you give? So excellent answer for evolution here. How about another one? Molecular machines, here's the kinesin motor protein. Do you know in each of your cells, you have these little robots that carry things from one part of the cell to the other, and they walk down little roads in your cell. Can you imagine that? It's like little nano tugboats, they're called, and because your cell is like a miniature factory. You know, in Darwin's day, they thought the cell was like a blob of jelly. They called it protoplasm, but now we know the cell is like a miniature factory, many active processes, many things going on, and so you need these little robots to carry materials around from one place to another. So it might be possible to think about evolving into some jelly, but you know, evolving something like this, I mean, it just boggles the mind. You can't even imagine how something like this would have happened over some gradual process. One more thing we'll look at, irreducible complexity, big word. What does it mean? It means if you take away one part of a complex system, it will no longer function. So here's an old-fashioned mousetrap. I still buy these. You get them at the dollar store, right? Two for a dollar. They do a great job still of catching mice. You know, there's only five parts, but let's say I buy some at the dollar store. I get them home. I open the package, and I find, oh, it's missing a part. Maybe the hammer's missing. Well, that's okay. It's only missing one part out of five. You know, it'll still catch like 80% chance of catching a mouse, right? Or if it was missing two parts, well, okay, it's got a 60% chance I may still catch some mice, right? No. Of course not. You would say, well, it's defective. It's not going to catch any mice unless one accidentally stumbles on it and falls off a cliff or something like that. You need all of these parts in the right place working together at the same time, or it is simply not going to function as a complex unified system. I mean, think about the human body. We have a circulatory system. It needs a heart. It needs a brain to send signals. Unless you have all of this working together at the same time, then it doesn't work. It doesn't make any sense. So in the end, a very basic problem with evolution is that nothing works until everything works. You cannot create a complex system, a piecemeal, a little bit at a time. You really need all the parts in there functioning together, or it's simply not going to work. We could say here, what is the ultimate reality? You know, we came from the mind of God. We have minds because we're created in the image of God. But if you look at matter, that is like the dirt outside, right? So those of us with minds, I think that includes everyone here, we're conscious, we're self-aware, we can think and reason, we can love, but can the dirt, even advanced dirt, right? Evolving advanced dirt, can it ever cross this tremendous chasm, right? Because matter is physical, right? So how can the physical ever create these non-physical properties of self-awareness, thinking, reasoning, and love? And the answer is it cannot. It simply cannot, because you're trying to take a physical thing and create non-physical aspects from it. It's really an impossibility, and this is a divide that evolution, you know, could never cross. Did you know that the Bible talks about dinosaurs? Yes, in Job chapter 40, verse 15, here God is speaking to Job, and he says, "Look at the behemoth which I made along with you, and which feeds on grass like an ox. What strength he has in his loins, what power in the muscles of his belly. His tail sways like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are close-knit, his bones are tubes of bronze, his limbs like rods of iron. He ranks first among the works of God." Right? When we think about the greatest creatures that ever existed on earth, this is what comes to mind, right? The dinosaurs, they far surpass in grandeur anything that's still living today. But you know this idea that dinosaurs died 65 million years ago? It's even affected our Bible translators. Look at this. If you look in the NIV Bible, the footnote on the behemoth, what does it say? Possibly the hippopotamus or the elephant. Well, did you ever look at the rear end of a hippo or an elephant? Well, there they are. Go ahead, take a close look, right? Do those look like tails that sway like a cedar tree? Well, of course not. They got little tiny tails, right? Especially that hippo. It's nothing like a cedar tree. But you look at the tails of those giant dinosaurs, those do look like cedar trees. And in fact, there's a lot of evidence that, you know, dinosaurs have lived with man in the past, and dinosaurs fit well into biblical history, right? We believe they were formed with the other animals on day six, but just like the people, they also, you know, started to do bad things. The flood came along. Noah didn't bring along giant dinosaurs. He brought in the baby juveniles, right? The young studs. They are the ones that came on board because they're going to have to repopulate the earth. But you know, the environment after the flood was different. A lot of them, they just couldn't make it. And we've all heard the tales of dragons, right? There's many reports from reliable witnesses that are written down of encounters with dragons, which were really dinosaurs. And in the end, we believe people really killed off, you know, the last of them. In the 1800s, they were rediscovered, and it wasn't until the 1800s that that term dinosaur was actually invented and used, which is why you do not find it in your King James Bible, for example, because it wasn't a word that even existed at that time. Here's an Inca stone from Peru. Look at clear depictions of dinosaurs, implying people were familiar with them and drew them. Here's one on a carving from Cambodia on a temple. It looks like a stegosaurus, right? It's got those things on its back. And we could show really, you know, many, many examples of places where people have clear depictions of dinosaurs from the past. So the only conclusion you can reach is that, you know, man did exist with the dinosaur because they're recorded in many places. Maybe 10 years ago or so, a very surprising thing happened, which is scientists opened up a dinosaur bone and they found, to their amazement, soft tissue inside, soft, flexible tissue, even red blood cells that still looked intact and still looked red. Now, it's one thing to believe that you might have some soft material after, say, a couple of thousand years, which is what we would believe these dinosaurs are from. But for 65 million years to still have soft tissue, it really defies any kind of common logic. And in fact, scientific experiments done recently have really shown that these components cannot last that long of 65 million years. So this is really a big point of controversy nowadays and what explains it, right? I know if I close up a paint can, put it on the shelf, come back a year later, open it up, it's probably all hard and dried up, right? So I can't even get something, you know, to last for a year or two. And 65 million years, it's just not even scientifically possible for these things to last that long. According to the secular view of history or anthropology, you know, man, there was evolution. Eventually we got to like a caveman stage. And then through further evolution, we became intelligent and capable. So here we are today, intelligent and capable. But the Bible has a different view of things, which is that man was started initially from Adam and his descendants as very intelligent and capable, probably smarter and more capable than we are today. And that they developed cities, music, worked with metals. But unfortunately, many times, right, people turn away from God and they become what the Bible terms as fools, which basically means they're trying to live their life on their own without honoring the Lord. So, in Genesis chapter 4, we read this. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all who play stringed instruments and pipes. Zillah also had a son, Tubal-Cain, who forged all kinds of tools out of bronze and iron. Now, we can quickly read that and say, okay, so what? No big deal, right? So they made some instruments, some pipes. They worked with some bronze and iron. But did you know that iron, to work with iron has a melting point of almost 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit? This is not something you're going to do in your kitchen at home, right? So, according to metal workers, working with iron is actually a pretty advanced technology, okay? And we see that people very early on, right, shortly after the Garden of Eden and then the cities and things, that they were working with iron, quite an advanced technology for that time. According to the Bible, there were no such thing as pre-men. And in fact, when you look at all of the skulls that have been dug up in the end, they all get classified either as some type of ape or as some type of human. So really, the missing link, in fact, is still missing. Okay, and in the end, you can clearly divide these skulls into different categories. Now, some of the humans may have looked a little bit different, but that can be explained through other factors. But in the end, there's apes, there's humans, and there's really nothing in between. A lot of people don't realize this, but if you look at the genealogies of the Bible, you see that there were 9 generations alive together before the flood. You know, Adam knew Lamech, who was the, right before Noah. So in fact, what it shows is that Noah really had easy and ready access to the historical information all the way back to the Garden of Eden, right? It wasn't like it was many, many generations ago or whatever. He could have had, you know, handed down one or twice information. And we believe, of course, he took that with him on the ark, and then eventually that became part of our Bibles. So the flood's an important event in Genesis, and I've heard it said that if the Bible didn't talk about the flood, we'd have to make it up, because we have to explain the geologic column somehow. But in fact, we're not going to focus on that today. That'll be a focus of a future week. But what would we expect out of a global flood? Well, we would expect this exactly, that billions of dead things buried in rock layers laid down by water all over the earth, that's what we would find, and in fact, that's what we do find. We will have to get out of our heads this view about Noah's Ark being a happy day at the zoo and the ridiculousness of full-size elephants being brought on board a tiny ark. But again, that's a subject for another day. After the flood, it talks about how God wanted the people to disperse, right, to repopulate the world. But instead, they decided to hang out together and build a city called Babel and build a tower there. And in Genesis chapter 11, we read, it was called Babel because there the Lord confused the languages of the whole world. And by doing this, he really forced the people to disperse, and they went in different directions. Different clans went to Europe, into Africa, and over to Asia. Now, these people groups, of course, they developed different characteristics, right, because they were inbreeding in small populations. So the people that went in these different directions, they develop different characteristics. But, you know, in the Bible, there is only one race of people. It's the human race. All of these other differences, these are superficial and skin deep, right? And racism has no place in the Christian church. And the Bible does not endorse a racism in any way. But we have an explanation for why different people groups have different characteristics. But there's only one race, the human race, according to the Bible. We can look at this book, The Puzzle of Ancient Man. People are always surprised by the fact that ancients, oh, they had this advanced technology. How could that be? Because they were just like cavemen who were, you know, learning how to do things, right? But we see things like the pyramids, the giant stones that fit well together, the desert drawings, and we, not even sure today, right? How are some of these amazing things done? But we got to get this idea out of our heads that ancient man was somehow primitive and didn't know much. No. Adam was very smart, and he was very capable, and his descendants were likewise. Here's an interesting book. After the flood, this man, Bill Cooper, he's researched in the libraries of Europe and shown how the history of Europe can be traced back to Noah through historical documents that you actually find in the libraries. No one bothered to do it, really, before this man, and he's
Here's one example from his book where he shows how Noah and all of the recorded descendants of Noah eventually brought about Brutus, the first king of England, about 1000 BC. So an interesting book, and it does show the historical, though, reality of Noah, and it's right there in the libraries in Europe if you look. Greek mythology, it has references back, right, to the Bible and paradise. Here's a picture of a serpent entwining a fruit tree. Well, hey, that sounds familiar, serpent, fruit tree, all right. How about in China, if you look at the most ancient bone characters, they're called, look at the word for boat. It's made out of three glyphs, vessel, eight people. Hey, what does that sound like? You know, Noah's ark had eight people on it, so there's the word for boat. You can look at the word for create, speak, dust, life, walk. Certainly sounds like the creation of Adam in the Garden of Eden. And in this book, it outlines many, many such examples. You look at the American Indians. They have one of the oldest recorded histories in this thing called the Red Record. And it talks about in there the creation, the flood. It talks about their migration over the Bering Strait down into Canada, down into the United States, all the way here to the East Coast. In fact, these Lanai, Lenape Indians existed even in our area here. So here's a couple of examples from the book, right? At the beginning, the sea everywhere covered the earth. Flooding and flooding, filling and filling, smashing and smashing, drowning and drowning, clear references to the flood. So how about the worldview implications now of Genesis? Well, the first thing to note is that the worldview of a society, it has immense consequences. One we can show is animals and people, for example. We mentioned this earlier. According to the Bible, animals and people are separate creations. But if you have this evolutionary view, you believe that man is just a higher order animal, you're going to want to elevate the place of animals to be more like people, and you're not going to put the honor that people should have. So you have things like abortion at the front end of life and euthanasia at the end of life. Now, as Bible-believing Christians, though, we should be the best in terms of the honoring of animals and the environment, right? There's no excuse for us not to be that way. We should, in fact, be leading the way in those areas. But you know what? In any given situation, if we have to choose between helping people, helping animals, we got to go on the side of people. It's people that are made in the image of God and that are most important. But we always look for solutions, of course, that can work both ways. Hitler was very much a believer in evolution. If we look at the quote on the bottom, Himmler, the head of the Gestapo, said this: "The law of nature must take its course in the survival of the fittest." This is the motto of evolution, the survival of the fittest. But can you think of a more un-Christian way of thinking, right? The Christian is supposed to help out the downtrodden, right? Those that cannot help themselves. We're not supposed to be exterminating them and getting rid of them. So really, this idea of evolution is very, very much against the concepts of Christianity. So we see other results of a non-biblical worldview, things like people really aren't special, right? As Bill Nye believes, he's just a speck. Laws must evolve with society, leading to acceptance of gay marriage, relative morality, and these sorts of things, right? But in the end, the problem is the Christian gospel message can seem to be irrelevant. And in fact, studies show that most people who are unchurched, who are not Christians, they're not really against Christianity. It's just they see it as irrelevant for themselves. So that's really our task, is to address this idea of relevance. But then the big problem in the end, of course, is that if people do not understand the Christian gospel message, in the end, they're what? They're lost to an eternity in hell. You know, God does not send anyone to hell, but if you go through your whole life saying to God, "No thanks, no thanks, no thanks, not interested," in the end, God says, "Okay, you're not interested, that's fine. You live over here in hell where I'm not, and now I've given you your wish," right? Because God is not going to force himself onto anybody. Genesis is a battleground, as we know, right? Not only in science, but in public education, and indeed the entire public sphere. There is a fading influence, unfortunately, right, of the Bible, God, and Christianity, and it has to do with this tremendous amount of information we get to the contrary, right, from our media, from our culture, from our society at large, and it really is hard to stand against that. Many distortions are even exist in our churches. In the end, though, what institution really has more authority, right? Is it the Bible that's authored by God through men, has not changed, honors God, reveals truths from God? Or is it science, right, which comes from men? Theories are always changing. Does not acknowledge God anymore. I think it did maybe 150 years ago. Today it really doesn't. It does discover facts, but sometimes the interpretations are not correct, right, because they're working with a materialistic worldview and assumptions. I like this picture from Answers in Genesis. It's been around for a while, but it shows on the right how the Christian community has really been focusing a lot of its efforts on the ill effects that come out of this secular humanism view, right? Fighting things like abortion and racism and other things like that. But in the meantime, those that are against us, what have they been doing? They have been attacking our foundation. They have been attacking Genesis, getting people quite successfully, more so, to say, is there even a God? Is thee the creator? Is marriage really between a man and a woman, right? All these things are found in Genesis, and so they're smart enough to know that that's where they place their attack, and once they do that, then the rest is going to crumble over time. And it stems from Psalm 11, verse 3, when the foundations are being destroyed, what can the righteous do? Well, what can we do? Well, we can strive to develop, teach, and maintain a traditional Christian worldview, call it a Christian worldview, biblical worldview, Genesis worldview, those would all be really the same. First for yourself and then for your children. And of course, it's not easy. As I mentioned, we have this continual flood of anti-information coming at us from many, many sources that we have to sort out and deal with. But in the end, it starts with Genesis, and that's what we're going to be doing over the next several weeks. And I very much look forward to it and hope.